Dylan Redmond's indefatigable search for his brother Owen has entered its 29th year. For an adult life largely consumed by the search, Dylan speaks remarkably soberly on the subject of his brother's disappearance.
I think it's a lot of people find it kind of awkward. It's not a comfortable topic.
Owen tells us a story that's deceptively simple. On one otherwise unremarkable day, a man disappears. People look for him and find nothing.
There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. Islands can be big and small, my love, for you will never go.
Dylan Redmond is a burly man in his mid-40s with chestnut brown curly hair, a musician and former high school teacher. He has long been the official spokesperson of the search for Owen, acting as both foreman and driver, overseeing all parts of the mystery as it unfolded. Any online search for Owen Redmond will return the same picture used by police in search posters. It shows a man grinning, head slightly inclined to one side, a mop of shoulder-length red hair in wild disarray, a dimpled chin and a broad, easy smile. In the Redmond family, Owen was the oldest, Dylan the youngest. Dylan believes his big brother felt responsible for him. The irony that he has now been returning the favour for most of his life is not lost on Dylan. In 29 years, the streets of Brunswick, a suburb in Melbourne's inner north, exist largely as Owen left them. Of course, there are some obvious marks of gentrification. Many weatherboard cottages and post-war cream brick houses have made way for multi-storey townhouses and manicured gardens, and the area is trendier, more upmarket. But it still maintains its multicultural, laid-back feel. In 1991, Brunswick was a bohemian mecca and a grimmer part of the city than most. It was here that Owen nurtured a wide network of friends amongst local communities of artists and musicians. And it was also here, on a lazy summer day, that he didn't arrive at work. No one has seen him since. The dawn of the 90s was a long time ago. There was no internet or mobile phones, and people still posted letters. The most bankable movie stars were Kevin Costner and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Kurt Cobain was still alive and Nirvana was yet to release their seminal album, Nevermind. The passing of almost 30 years doesn't help Owen's case. With time, the supporting cast of characters and their names have faded completely. Principal witnesses have long vanished or are unavailable for comment. It seems like an impossible task to plumb memories for insights into an event that took place nearly 30 years ago. And the scant details we have, carefully maintained by the vigilant younger brother, might just be all there are. In February 1991, Dylan, then aged 20, received a phone call from his brother's wife. Owen's now ex-wife did not want to be named, preferring to distance herself from the case completely. For our purposes, we'll call her Karen.
Karen said she hadn't seen Owen for a month. She told us he would often disappear for a few weeks at a time, take off to a festival or he'd just not come home. But he always came back. But this time was different. He hadn't come back.
Over the phone, Karen explained that Owen had left all his belongings and that Dylan and his father would need to come and collect them before his housemates tossed it all on the front lawn. When Owen vanished, he took nothing. He wasn't a materialistic person and owned very little. His most treasured possession was an old oak chest, carefully crafted by his grandfather, who'd been a sailor in the Merchant Navy. He left this behind, along with his passport, clothes, and the contact lens cleaning kit, which he took with him everywhere. At the time, Owen had been working as a subscription salesman for Greenpeace around the Brunswick and Collingwood areas. Before he vanished, he hadn't collected his pay.
I was living at home with Dad, so we both jumped in the car, drove for a couple of hours down to St Kilda Road to missing persons and made a report.
When Owen disappeared in February, John Redman, Owen's father, hadn't seen his son in 4 months. In a statement to police, John explained that the last time he saw Owen was roughly 4 months earlier, around Owen's birthday on October 8. He said his son was upset as he'd recently split from his wife. Owen was born in the New South Wales town of Tumut in the Snowy Mountains, where his parents met. Within a few years, the small family moved to Papunya, near Alice Springs, where John Redman taught Indigenous children. The Redmans had nomadic tendencies, with their father's work moving them from Papunya, where Dylan was born, to Darwin, then Brisbane, before finally settling down in Churchill, Victoria, when Owen was a teenager. Life assumed a transitional pattern as they shifted from one adventure to the next. For the majority of his adult life, relations between Owen and his parents were cool at best. His mother was a devout Christian, and despite being taken to church, Owen never agreed with her Pentecostal faith, preferring his father's agnosticism. So when his parents eventually divorced, it seemed natural for 17-year-old Owen to move in with his father.
That was when my family shattered, and they went in different directions. Mum moved to Warragul, Dad moved further out to Trafalgar, both of which are towns in the Gippsland region of Victoria. Her parents' divorce dealt a massive blow to my brother Owen. He was the oldest, he took the greatest responsibility. He took the brunt of the conflict. He went with Dad to Trafalgar to finish school, but there was a lot of tension. They were too much like each other.
Dylan describes them both as being intellectuals, each defending strong points of view with similar levels of obstinacy. Owen became agitated by his new life in Trafalgar. As soon as he finished school in year 12, he left his father's home to enrol in university, and from that point on, began keeping his family at arm's length.
He was a massive smart aleck, my brother. He was very intelligent and would rub people up the wrong way. He would make people look silly sometimes. Not on purpose, I don't think, but he knew a lot about a lot, and he wasn't afraid to say it sometimes, much to his detriment. I remember one particular day he came home from school and my sister was crying and Owen had blood all over his face and all over his shirt. And it was just simply that I think what had happened is he'd stood up to someone on the bus but used words that they probably didn't understand, and rather than using words that he probably wouldn't understand back, they used fists. Some people would give him crap, so he'd give it back and then they'd get mad and punch him. It seemed like the only comeback that people knew in the town of Churchill at the time.
Owen had a habit of pushing people's buttons to see how they'd respond. This wasn't a trait that faded with age. Even just 6 months before he went missing, he'd gotten involved in a similar altercation. At La Trobe University, Owen set about remaking himself. Dissatisfied with his commerce degree, he dropped out to enrol in philosophy, then drama. In studying drama and music, Owen found his calling. And for that, he decided he didn't need university. So he dropped out. He moved to the beachside suburb of St Kilda and tried out a string of jobs in restaurants before working for Greenpeace. A music fan, his collection featured the 80s anthems of INXS, The Police, and Midnight Oil. Owen became a passionate guitarist, working at Greenpeace by day while assembling a band by night. They recorded a rough, low-fidelity demo with himself on vocals and guitar, which his brother recalls as evoking an acerbic energy of Nirvana and Soundgarden. While living in Barclay Street, St Kilda, Owen Redman would sometimes sneak his teenage brother Dylan into gigs at famed venues like the Espy and the Corner Hotel. Afterwards, they'd wander by streetlight discussing ideas and laughing over beers and falafels. Dylan remembers his brother once walking down the street, howling fearlessly into the night. Yet beneath Owen's laid-back approach was a timeless gravity. he was frequently seen carrying around a copy of Tolstoy's War and Peace. Perhaps Owen identified with the novel's protagonist, the young misfit Pierre Bezukhov, perplexed by his place in a world of wealth, ambition, and excess. In 1989, Owen married, in his own words, for fun. There are photos of him and his bride, grinning with flowers in their hair, standing before a celebrant and several witnesses in the Dandenong Mountains.
Oh, I saw it as a bit of a joke. I don't think he took marriage seriously because of my parents' breakup. Didn't think he actually got married. I thought it was just a big joke, big pretend, but actually it turned out it was for real and it caused quite a few problems for his ex-wife later down the track.
Initially, the couple seemed to enjoy married life. They shared adventures and fostered one another's acting aspirations, leading them to snag bit parts in the 90s Western film Quigley Down Under, starring Tom Selleck and Alan Rickman. Neither Owen nor Karen appeared in the credits, however, and Dylan suspects they used screen names. But the relationship soon proved to be a turbulent one. For the next 2 years, the newlyweds lived in Brunswick, although they preferred to remain in their separate share houses rather than live together. Despite being social, Owen had trouble in his relationships and preferred relative isolation, often between bouts of partying. Never being one for order and structure, he was impulsive, living each day as it came, and this approach also applied to his marriage. Eventually, Karen said she wanted to leave the relationship. Dylan says the problem lay with Owen's anger issues. By all accounts, he was an affable but intense young man with a fierce temper. If something was bothering him, Owen wasn't forthright about sharing his frustration, instead letting a brooding inward rage build. Dylan believes these issues led to the downfall of his marriage.
Owen wasn't really a violent person, but he just let his anger build up and then he would just release it. And I guess it was a bit of a family trait, really. He'd just spit the dummy, rant and rave, maybe he'd chuck things, maybe he'd break things that were, I don't know, I suppose important. But it just made it difficult for him to be in a relationship, his ex-wife said.
The image Dylan presents of his brother is of a man who was friendly but had a darker side characterised by impatience and animosity. Yet his anger wasn't always petty in nature. Dylan says his brother would frequently rail against the ills of the world and his sense of outrage at global injustices escalated as he grew older. Despite channeling his active social conscience into causes like Greenpeace, something still gnawed at him. According to Karen, she and Owen shared a fairly open relationship. Owen had some dalliances with other women in their friendship group, and towards the end of his marriage, he had started to experiment sexually with men. Owen had gone missing before, but never for a length of time that caused much concern. His small breaks gave him an outlet for his impulsivity, and he often hitchhiked to music festivals, vanishing without notice, only to return unannounced 1 or 2 weeks later, as though nothing had happened. These previous impromptu trips gave his family no cause for alarm, except on one occasion.
When I was 17, it was really strange. I was planning to go to America as an exchange student and I hadn't seen Owen for some time, so I wanted to catch up before I left. I was going for 12 months and it just seemed like it made sense to catch up before we left. And he was still living in St Kilda at this time, I thought anyway, and I called his phone and it was disconnected. So I visited his apartment in Barclay Street only to find there was someone else there. He'd moved out but didn't pass on his details. So the only way we could get hold of him was to put a note in his Centrelink payment to saying, hey, Dylan's going overseas. He wants to see you before he goes. And then he showed up.
Over the following years, Owen developed considerable evasive skills, sometimes going so far as to create new identities. He adopted a number of aliases, including the names Simon or Stuart Moore.
He liked talking about screen names. And he came up with some pretty cool ones, to be honest. Stage names as well. He even changed his birth certificate, changed the date, I think for job purposes.
But there was no indication that he planned to use these names on a permanent basis. Dylan saw this as another harmless affection for his occasionally eccentric older brother. Having been largely separated since their teenage years, the two brothers really reconnected a year before Owen disappeared. Dylan sometimes drove from the Latrobe Valley and stayed at Owen's place in Brunswick for the weekend. From there, they'd go to St Kilda, visit pubs, see bands and just hang out.
I remember a moment walking towards the National Theatre on Barclay Street one night and he said, "You know, Dylan, I'm really sorry for the way I treated you." That was a significant moment for me. That is a moment that brought us back, I think, to a place where I was the closest person to him and our family.
In the weeks before he left, Owen's behaviour noticeably changed. According to Dylan, he stopped his tantrums, stopped smoking, and reined in his partying while saving money. In hindsight, it was clear he'd started to shut everyone out.
Karen said it was like he was slowly withdrawing, and looking back, she could see Owen was preparing to do something. His actions in working harder, saving more and isolating himself suggested he was planning on making a change. And when the day came, he didn't call his wife or leave a note or letter. He just wasn't there anymore. I think she thought it was going to happen eventually. She felt there was a sense of inevitability about it.
After he vanished in 1991, there's been no consensus as to exactly what happened to Owen. The coroner ruled him as deceased in 2015, citing that there had been no proof of life across a quarter of a century.
I appreciate all the work that the police did, but to be honest, that was like a knife in the back. When I received that letter from the coroner, I've spent 29 years imagining every possibility. It gets too frustrating to think about. You get used to living with it and just get on with your life. But sometimes it's important just to pause and think about it, reflect, think about Owen.
Having had a difficult relationship with their oldest son, Owen's parents didn't exhibit much evidence of shock or grief. They seemed somewhat unperturbed by his disappearance, as they grew to accept that perhaps this time he was gone for good.
On the surface, Mum didn't appear to grieve. Not outwardly, at least. She believed God would look after him and she'd put Owen in God's hands, and I can understand that. She probably felt like she was a failure and that to some degree it was her fault because of divorce and all the stuff that went on. He was the oldest and he really took everything on his shoulders. But she also felt Owen had made his own decision. And I guess she probably felt powerless to do anything. And I think that's a prevailing feeling that all people have when they have family members go missing. Because the only thing you can really control is how you respond to it. Can't control a person, can't make them come back. She didn't put any energy into trying to find him, but I suspect that she felt a profound sense of grief and regret.
On one occasion, the Redmond family thought they'd found a lead. Several years after Owen disappeared, they received a letter, supposedly from Owen, containing information on his whereabouts. He claimed he was in Carnarvon in Western Australia and was near death after a drug overdose. For Dylan, this was the breakthrough he'd been hoping for. He thought it was his brother, warding him off the search. However, he eventually discovered, with the aid of police, that the letter was authored by Karen's mother. In an attempt to gain closure for her abandoned daughter, she'd been to see a psychic and then wrote the anonymous letter pretending to be her son-in-law.
I think the worst part about this is there are lots of weird people who come up with all sorts of crazy ideas about what's happened, and they're not afraid to say, and they don't consider the fact that most of what they say is garbage. Just not helpful. I've had lots of people who've come to me and said, "Oh, I've been to a psychic. I want to tell you all about it." I'm like, "Don't tell me." And it seems immature, but there have been times I've even stuck my fingers in my ears and gone, "La, la, 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 I don't want to hear," because it's always different. I've had one person tell me after being a psychic that he threw himself off a cliff on the Great Ocean Road and that no one would ever see his body again. But the worst part about that was I was driving tours along the Great Ocean Road at the time, so it made that work all the more difficult. Driving along those steep cliffs every day, and it always come to the point where they said that he jumped off, and I'd always be wondering, well, maybe it did happen. Did it really happen? Was this the place, you know? And it was, well, very distracting, but it was just so far-fetched that I can't imagine Owen doing that. But before he left, his ex-wife Karen said that he'd tried to end his own life and cut his wrist. She discovered him, but she wasn't sure if it was more of a cry for help or the real deal.
This cutting incident took place less than a year before Owen went missing. He went to hospital, wrists bandaged. But Dylan believes that if his brother planned a suicide, he would have left a note. However, he acknowledges that another tragedy could have befallen Owen. He might have fallen victim to foul play. Despite owning a car, Owen was an avid hitchhiker, and his disappearance corresponds with the period when one of Australia's most notorious serial killers, Ivan Milat, was murdering young backpackers. Milat's killings spanned from 1989 to 1993, and since his arrest in 1994, police have theorised that he may have been involved in many more murders than the seven that led to his conviction. While the Milat theory is a plausible one, no evidence exists to prove it. Some have suggested that Owen's love for the natural world may have led him to volunteer with the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which he always held in high regard. Police investigators further speculated that Owen might have decided to rediscover his roots by relocating to an outlying Indigenous settlement or cattle station in Western Australia or the Northern Territory. As far as Dylan is concerned, there are only two possible outcomes, neither of which are particularly good.
People just randomly ask, what do you think's happened to your brother? It's just so insensitive and just so, it's just a big slap in the face. But my theory is either he's dead, which I don't want, obviously, or he's out there and he doesn't want to be part of my family. And I can kind of understand that to some degree. I would like him to be part of my family, but I can understand why he didn't want to potentially reconnect with my mother or father. But my gut feeling is that he's not dead.
If Owen is still in Australia somewhere, Dylan is confident his brother would be aware of the search for him.
I've been on the news asking him to reach out, saying, we don't expect to have a relationship if you don't want it. There's too much water under the bridge. There's too much that has happened. And I know it would be really uncomfortable. But I just want to know that you're okay. That's my own message to my brother, is just want to know that you're okay.
He admits that although people want a happy ending, there's a strong likelihood that in this case, there won't be one. Dylan hopes that through his advocacy for his brother, he can also encourage people who are thinking of disappearing to think twice.
My message to people that are thinking about taking off and never coming back is that you don't realise what you're doing, especially to the people who love you. You don't realise how it's going to affect them, and you might think, no one cares. No one gives a stuff, I'm just going to take off. And a lot of people's default is to simply run away when things get too tough. My own default is to run away, or want to run away when things get too tough. But at the end of the day, if you love someone, you stick around and work out what the issue is, whatever it might be. My brother probably doesn't even realise what sort of impact his leaving had on all of us.
Dylan will join me in the studio after this word from our sponsors. And now Dylan joins me in the studio for a conversation about the disappearance of his brother. Thank you for doing this, Dylan. I know that it is not easy. It doesn't get easier over all the years, but you do, I guess, get a bit more used to it.
I don't know about used to it, but prepared.
I do want to know, firstly, about the time difference. You know, my brother went missing 9 years ago, very different to 1991. Mm. This is pre-social media, pre-the internet, pre-all of these technologies that families in this predicament typically look to, especially in the early stages. How different do you think your experience is because of that time difference? How would it be if Owen went missing, say, 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think about that a lot. I think social media's made it easier to reach out to people, and I've noticed a change over the years since Owen went missing. It's sort of, you could do the old school stuff, you know, put posters up around and things like that, and boots on the ground, go and actually visit places and meet people. But that was super time consuming. Not that I'm saying I don't want to. I didn't want to, but it's more that I can do so much more now, and so I can reach so many more people and be so much more effective. I think also it would have been easier for Owen to hide back then because, well, you just could. You could change your name. You could be someone completely different.
Is 1991 kind of like a yardstick for you? Do you think of it in terms of that was, whenever something happened in history, are you like, that was, you know, 6 years before Owen went missing or 3 years after he disappeared? Is that a moment in your life that has kind of separated like a pre-post scenario for you?
Never thought of it like that. Sort of like AD and BC.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I think I liken it to when my mother passed away, and she passed away very suddenly. She was in a car accident, and it was things like that where I felt like I could just call my mum and just say, hey, mum. And she was the sort of person that'd be like, no, that's a silly idea, don't do it. Or she'd be like, okay, yeah, that sounds all right. And she was pretty direct. And I think it was stuff like that with my brother where I knew I could call him up. And he's probably the one I could talk to about music and different things. And so removing that, it was sort of like that was one dynamic in my life that was no longer there. I think it's so long ago now, though, it's probably not as profound, but it's just there's the profoundness is in that dull kind of feeling that I have, or dampened feeling that I have when I think of my brother. You know, when I hear different stories, even, you know, recount some of the things that we used to do, I feel a sense of, like, I start to laugh thinking of the silly things we used to do, but it's not as strong, I suppose, as it used to be, because it almost doesn't feel real anymore. It feels like a movie or something. Yeah, so there's that, I guess, loss of innocence as well. I guess it has two effects. It makes me personally question, what the heck am I doing with my life, and am I making a difference? Am I doing anything worthwhile? But I guess it also makes you value the people that are around you even more so, because it's like, well, could I lose them as well one day for one reason or another?
Well, that's certainly a positive out of a negative, to use that to fuel you to do, you know, something with your life that you think you would be proud of, he would be proud of.
But it also makes things more profound when things do go wrong. I mean, even recently, Lisa and I are sponsoring 3 children in Cambodia. We pay for them to go to school. It's nothing to us. I mean, it's like it's nothing financially to us. But, you know, it's like $140 a month or something, which is nothing to pay for someone to get an education, to change their life. But one of our sponsor kids went missing, like disappeared from the school and didn't come back after the school holidays. And it was like, obviously for some people, it would be like, oh, that's terrible, I feel really upset. But for me, it's like, multiply it by 100. We found out eventually what had happened. The mum had remarried and they'd moved back to the provinces. So moved away from Phnom Penh. So I think she's okay. But for that 2 or 3 months where I didn't know what had happened, and I'd just gotten this phone call saying, oh, Dylan, we're really sorry, but one of your sponsored children has not returned to school and we don't know where she is. It was just like, oh, you know, it's like someone punched me in the throat. I just, I couldn't, I don't know, like I couldn't breathe when they first said that.
Gosh, the shock and the panic and going back to that initial moment, you know, 30 years ago and, oh, that's terrifying. I even freak out when someone's not where they're supposed to be after, you know, if they're typically reliable and they're not there after 20, 30 minutes, then I start to panic, depending on the context. But it does change you. It does, those events stay with you.
Gives you a worst case scenario that's probably deeper than what most people would experience. Yeah, because you go to that, oh, that feeling of like, this is really bad, when sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's not really bad, but I guess we have that inbuilt default now of like, have they gone missing? Have they disappeared? But the other flip side of that too is I find it really disgusting when people are really flippant about people disappearing. And, you know, there was a lady that we knew whose daughter would do a runner every so often, and she'd always be calling the police and, oh, my daughter's gone missing, and calling missing persons. And I would just want to just give her a serve and just like calm down and stop wasting police resources on just because you and your daughter have had a fight and she's decided not to come home. She's staying with a friend. But she would call missing persons all the time. And I'm just like, you don't get it. What a waste of police resources when they could be, you know, finding real missing people. So that really pisses me off when I hear that.
Yeah, I think that would be the case for many people. But it is, it's complicated because, you know, children are particularly vulnerable and you just, you don't know what's happening when they are repeat missing. Like that's a sign that there is an issue that needs addressing and that has to be prioritised so that they're not draining the police resources. The whole thing needs to be reframed. Yeah. I wonder, though, what the response was like almost 30 years ago when your adult brother, who had a history of sometimes just going away for a while without telling anyone, how did the police treat that?
I think they pretty much were very, I wouldn't say blasé. And look, the police have been wonderful. Some of the police have not been so wonderful, but the majority of the police that I've worked with have been amazing. But their response at the time, I think, was pretty much, well, he's, you know, look, he's a grown adult. He's made a choice. He's decided to take off. You know, they showed an adequate amount of empathy and concern. But as you said, if it was a child, someone under the age of 18, it's panic stations. If it's someone over the age of 18, then it's not so much panic stations because, well, they can look after themselves. And it's only until maybe other things come into play. Like if, you know, there was reports of someone like Ivan Milat, you know, wandering around slaughtering people, you know. But I think at the time it was very much like, you know, the major report, we'll do our best to find this individual, but obviously there's so many people that do similar things or go missing for other reasons, you know, due to accidents or going bushwalking, things like that, getting stuck on a mountain somewhere. That it would be, I must imagine it would be very difficult for the police to prioritise which cases to put energy and time into.
Absolutely. So then what did they do to try and find Owen when he first went missing? Do you know?
From memory, they obviously would have visited where he lived. They would have tried to interview the people in the house, but knowing the people there at the time, I can imagine there would be a fairly large ambivalence towards talking to the police. I felt as though when we rocked up at their house, it was almost like they were not so keen to talk to us either. They were more comfortable with me because, well, they'd seen me before and they knew who I was. But when my father was there too, I guess they clammed up a bit and they seemed a bit cagey. But if the police were there, they would have struggled to want to let them into the house, you know, because share houses obviously have things lying around and that perhaps they don't want the police to see. And it was only until, I think, 2005 that they started to pick the ball up again and were looking to close cold cases. And that was when they asked me to come to like missing persons a week and things like that.
That's good to hear because I think there is often a mentality from police, certainly in generations past and still sadly today, that adult men who go missing have a right to go missing. I mean, everyone, any adult has a right to go missing. And I can understand the basis of that, but it's all about context. And when you're 24-year-old brother, in our case, was struggling with mental health issues, and we tried to convey the urgency around how out of character his disappearance was, and they reverted to that, oh, well, you know what, he's an adult male, he has a right to go missing. It can be very frustrating to feel that police aren't understanding your panic, and, you know, you're in a position where you know this person better than they do. They should be listening to you. Mm. So you didn't feel that, were your parents, I mean, I know eventually that they had sort of come to accept it, but was there any initial frustration that the authorities weren't doing more or didn't really understand that this was something that they needed to action?
I think the thing I forgot to say before was that I think in 1991, mental health was not really a thing. You know, a young male going to see a psychologist or a counsellor, or a young person or anyone really going to see a counsellor or a psychologist at the time, was heavily stigmatised and heavily like, whoa, you know, you must be mental, mate. You know, like it wouldn't have been a thing. It wouldn't have been a thing that people talked about openly. The police would never have probably even encountered that aspect of things. And even the way, I guess I've never felt, you know, felt like, oh, they didn't do a good job or they didn't care. But I think there wasn't that same observance of mental health, mental healthiness or lack thereof. But similar to you, I guess now that I think about it, there probably was that aspect of, well, he's a grown up, he can do, you know, do what he wants. And that's a mindset that a lot of people have. I wouldn't just limit that to the police. I think that a lot of people just kind of, they just rationalise and they're fairly pragmatic about it. It's like, oh, well, you know, how's your brother? Oh, yeah, I'm sure he's okay. He's probably down the local having a couple of beers and just hanging out.
Mm, absolutely. I do think a lot of people want to go with that because it's nicer for
it's
the families.
It's comfortable. It's comfortable to think that everything's okay and sweep it under the carpet, you know, but it's not nice to think that, you know, there's someone that you care about buried in a shallow grave somewhere or living on the streets or just in a really, really bad place. And I suppose if you delve into the depths of that kind of darkness, then you start to panic and you start to freak out and you start to feel, I don't know, a sense of like, well, I should be doing more. And, you know, and then it's easy to turn on yourself and start to be like, well, get off your bum and go and do something, you know. Yeah, I guess it was to some degree that sense of, well, he's a big boy. He can look after himself.
You said that your mum didn't actively search so much, that she didn't really put any energy towards trying to find where Owen went in the early stages. Was that frustrating for you? Was that confusing? Or how did that feel to not get the determination?
I remember being pretty angry with my parents. Look, we were a very fractured family though. We were in four or five different places. I guess it's a bit of a weird family that, well, and there was a divorce, there were other mitigating things behind that that made the Redmond family a very uncomfortable place to be. But, yeah, I do remember her rationalising it, kind of going, oh, look, he's made his choice, that's his decision. I remember kind of feeling like I wanted to say, well, you know, what is your problem? You know, why don't you care about your son? Why don't you want to do something about it? Sometimes I can't believe, I suppose, that they weren't running around putting up posters and making phone calls and doing a lot more. And I suppose I felt that weight of responsibility fairly firmly upon my shoulders. And not to say that they did nothing, but I guess, yeah, it would have been good to see them do a whole lot more.
Well, I think for families, many of the time there's at least one member, often parents, are simply and understandably totally paralyzed in shock that this whole scenario has happened. And I can only imagine that for your mum, who was a devout Christian, that there would have been enormous relief in turning to religion in a time like that.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways I've found a lot of hope in that myself. But I don't see that as an excuse to sit back and do nothing. I feel hope in that, you know, I believe there is a God that he's all-knowing, ever-present and all-powerful, and he's got my back. And that's honestly where I get my hope from. That's where I feel as though this is a really crappy situation, but I can turn it around to something good. I know this probably sounds weird, but in the sense that I know when I encounter other people who have experienced the same sort of hurt or loss, even, you know, obviously different, I can't say I completely understand because that's so trite and cliched and you just want to flick someone in the forehead when they say that. But I can say to people, I've got some understanding of how you feel, and to be able to empathize without projecting your own stuff upon people's situations is really, really powerful. I don't think I could have made it through without my church community around me and my friends around me who had my back and would see that I'm going through tough stuff, and then they would take me out for coffee or, you know, just hang out. And or when people said dumb stuff, they would be like, you know, tell them to shut up. But I think there's more to play than just sort of religion or whatever with my mum. I think that she just, like old school kind of, would have felt like, oh man, you know, is this my fault? I think there's a helplessness in that. It's like learned helplessness, you know. They did a psychology experiment on a dog that, which is really disgusting, but they would put it on an electrified wire and the dog would jump off, but eventually the dog would just lay there and just take it. And I think that there is a sense of that sometimes with families of like, I just feel so helpless, I don't know what to do, so I'm just going to do nothing. And I'm not, that's not a judgmental thing so much as, I mean, I get through times of that too. I just think, well, there's nothing I can do. Then I stand up and like, no way, I want to keep searching. I want to try and find new ways to find Owen and or just raise the awareness for the sense of missingness. And, you know, I encounter lots and lots of people that are going through that, and I love the fact that I can, I guess, be there with them and understand. I think love's the wrong word, but I appreciate that I can. I mean, even we were at in Hosier Lane and I was shooting some photos of a mural that had just gone up, and I remember the family came over to me and they were like, who are you and why are you taking photos? And then I said, oh, I just simply said, well, my brother Owen, he's a missing person as well. And immediately there was this connection, and immediately the guard went down there like, oh, you get it. And I don't love that I've got a missing brother, but I appreciate that I can connect with people. I wish my mum and my dad could have gotten involved too.
So you naturally fell into the position of spokesperson. There's typically one person in the family that has to do all of that comms between police and media and the public. Mm. And you were only 20 years old when this happened. Mm. So you just assumed that role naturally, or did your parents ask you to, you know, sort of be the front person? And
I think that I kind of had to do it because I don't think they wanted to step up. I remember even when the police came to me and asked for DNA and they said, oh, look, you're the only person. I think my sister did, but like my mother, they were on the way to my mum's to take DNA and she called them and said, no, don't come. I don't want to do it. I don't know why. Look, and, you know, I didn't even ask. I wasn't even going to go there. It's probably just one of those things you just, I don't know, never felt like you'd really have that sort of conversation. Yeah, it was just it's like, well, someone's got to do something about this and I'm just going to do it. I think at the end of the day, I was probably, of all the family members, probably was the person that connected with Owen the most before he disappeared. So for me, it was that profound sense of losing my brother and I just wanted him to come back. You know, I felt guilty. I felt ashamed of having a brother that was missing, and why didn't we do more, and why didn't we care for him more, and you know, why?
You know, why did you feel ashamed?
Well, I guess of like, well, I should have been there for him, and I should have been, probably shame is not really the right word, but it's that sense of like, wow, what a crappy family we have that we didn't get around my brother in his time of need.
So and you felt like it could have been prevented?
Yeah, absolutely. But in 1991, there was no, oh, are you okay day. There was no mental health plan. It was like people would feel helpless, so they would leave or they would take their own life.
And that's the thing. In Australia, at least, 85% of the time when someone goes missing, it relates to a mental health condition. Mm-hmm. And there is so much more awareness for the prevalence of mental health conditions now than what there would have been in 1991. So it's a completely different landscape that we're working in.
And now we know the questions, well, most people know the questions to ask. You know, are you thinking about taking your own life? Do you have a plan? And these don't seem like normal questions to ask somebody in that space. I mean, I asked them the other day, what would you say if someone said they didn't want to wake up or they were feeling suicidal? And this guy said, oh, yeah, I'd be like, oh, that's terrible. I feel really sorry for you. And I'm like, that is the worst thing you could say. And so I was able to educate him and say, well, no, actually, you need to just turn off anything that's you and just be there for them, be present and make sure that they're safe and ask the questions. And when I told him what questions I ask, he was like, no, I can never ask that. That doesn't make sense. I'm like, no, it completely makes sense. Making someone feel bad for feeling bad just compounds their negative feelings. I wish, though, that I guess the shame, regret, probably is more the appropriate word, is that I didn't know those questions to ask then and I didn't ask those questions.
We didn't have the vocabulary back then.
Yeah, true.
It wasn't in the lexicon in Australia in 1991.
But I think
it was only a recent thing.
I think at the time I was just immersed in my own stuff of my own and that I couldn't see beyond that to see, hey, I've got a hurting brother that is about to take off. And I think perhaps the lack of information too. I mean, it was a month after he didn't return that we got the phone call from Owen's ex-wife. And it's like it would have been helpful to know that. Yeah, I guess that was the hardest part. Too much time had expired and even a month after he disappeared, it was too long because he'd well and truly done whatever he was going to do, executed his plan to disappear. But again, I just keep coming back to, I wish. I wish I could have asked more questions. I wish I had known. Even there were times when the phone rang, I picked it up and just answered, hello. Some people, I remember people telling me, you sound just like your father. And I remember distinctly around the time that Owen disappeared, there were two or three phone calls where I answered hello and it was a pause and then the phone, like the receiver went down. And I was like, oh, you know, even to this day, unless it's like obviously not a number from, you know, someone I know or if it's like I suspect it's a telemarketer, I'll usually answer, hi, this is Dylan. Just because it's like that sense of like, it could be Owen, you know? I mean, now it would be, if Owen called, it would be, well, he would be calling me. He wouldn't be calling my home number, a landline. But that was old school, you know? One of those rotary phones where if you'd got the number wrong, you had to hang up and try again. And there was no caller ID, so who knows? I don't know who it was, but I remember distinctly and just thinking, damn, I wish I'd said, hi, this is Dylan. Why couldn't I have just said that? You know, but it's silly. It's just...
No, but it's so interesting the very obscure ways that this event marks people. Mm. And so the fact that you answer your phone now a certain way because of this, it's so fascinating. People outside this world wouldn't have any understanding of just...
Yeah,
how many little details?
Apart from it's really annoying when you ring someone up and they all sound the same, you're not sure who it is and you have to say, who is this? Like if I call my sister, if her two sons answer, it could be her husband or it could be her two sons because they all sound exactly the same. Yeah, but I guess there are certain things that have changed in my life as a result of that. I guess wanting to maintain an online presence through Facebook or whatever, just because Owen might go, oh, I'm going to search for Dylan. And I hope that he has, but I feel sad that he hasn't reached out and just said, hey, I'm okay. It's too weird. I don't know if we can reconnect. You know, too much water under the bridge, but I'm okay. Everything's all right. He can stop searching now. You know what I mean? just put things into perspective a bit, or perhaps just put things to rest and just go, hey, look, you can stop searching. I'm okay. I live in Byron Bay. I'm sipping on my latte right now. I'm having my vegan burger and life's good. I'm okay.
But I wonder if you'd even believe that if that did happen.
Yeah, I'd be like, well, that's crap. I'm coming to Byron Bay, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because we had people call and say, it's me, it's Dan, I'm okay, I'm in Queensland, you can stop looking for me. And I mean, you had, you know, Karen's mother writing a letter claiming to be Owen.
Yeah, well,
so
right.
there are lots of weirdos out there.
I suspect that Owen wouldn't be sipping on a latte anyway because he'd have too much respect for. No, I'm kidding. Just kidding.
Melbourne snob.
But yeah, that's, it'd be a magic for sure. But it's like, you know, I would hope that he could just kind of go, say, look, it's me, it's Owen, and this is, you know, I was born here, and do you remember that time when we were kids and this happened? And then I'd be like, oh, it really is Owen. Then he could just say, hey, look, I don't hate you. It'd just be too weird, too uncomfortable, but I just want to let you know it's okay. And if that happened, I would respect that. I wouldn't jump on the next plane and go up there and invade his privacy. I would just be like, okay, thanks for telling me. I appreciate it. I probably want to ask a million questions, but in the same token, if he didn't want to talk and he didn't want to say anything, if he could just say, I'm okay, that would be enough. Sort of. Probably not.
Well, yeah.
But I would respect that.
Yeah.
I would respect that. I mean, if I put myself in the same position, I can imagine reconnecting with a family I haven't seen in nearly 30 years would be just so hard.
It is hard when you do make yourself publicly known. And I mean, it's a story. It's a case, it's a story. Everyone's got an opinion. And with that comes a lot of hurt and sometimes harm when charlatans, you know, psychics come to you and share their visions and their ideas. And yes. I'm sure you've had plenty of that over the years.
Yes. Yes, I have. And I'm like, please don't tell me. I don't want to know. Not because I, you know, have a prejudice against psychics. I mean, my views on that aren't important so much as I just don't want to hear what they have to say in that sense, because I don't think that there's any validity in that. Because every time I've had this happen numerous times, and it's always a different story, and it's always something negative, and it's always something that just isn't helpful. It always just causes harm. And it's really no one's business to be doing that. If I wanted to see a psychic, I would, but I'm not into that. But what is more helpful is to say, hey, you know, I care about you. Are you okay? Not tell me your story, your brother, tell me all about it, or, you know, or I hypothesize that this has happened to your brother. I don't want to hear that, to be honest.
It's difficult because you can understand that people want to help and they want to share these brilliant ideas and thoughts that they have because they want you to have resolution, because it's not nice to not know, and not for anyone, particularly for the families to have to live with the constant wondering if it's that, or and particularly I think in Owen's case is that there are so many possibilities. You know, the scene is very different to most others in that, you know, he did have a history of disappearing for periods of time in the past, so there was already a delay in you know, starting the search. The fact that he had, you know, somewhat perhaps whimsically used aliases and stage names. And that also is a factor, you know, to consider. And you could back then, you know, you could just easily change your name and change your birth date for jobs and whatnot. It was a totally different time. Also the fact that he had attempted suicide and had expressed those thoughts.
Suicidal ideation, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's also, you know, he was somewhat reclusive at times, so that he maybe did want to just remove himself from. There are so many things going on that I can only imagine plague your brain daily, because I think most families can go, oh, I can rule that out. Even foul play was another one that you mentioned could be possible. You know, there are so many crazy but equally plausible possibilities that it's harder, I think, for people like you because you can't rule anything out. Like, we could rule out foul play. You know, we didn't think that that was relevant to Dan's case. And most families can rule out a few, but for you, it's just anything seems.
Yeah, and the further you get into it, the further it becomes more like a giant rabbit hole, really, in a sense, because, you know, I've had people ring me up and go, oh, yeah, or not ring me up, but, you know, contact me through Facebook or whatever and say, oh, yeah, I remember this. Around about the time your brother disappeared, there was this guy out at the Healesville pub that used to come out there and he spoke in a very, you know, educated voice and people got really annoyed with him and then he was with this local lady and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then you just kind of like, oh, maybe I should go out there. But then you go out there and then other people's perspectives would be completely different on that same individual. So it's sort of like this sense of like everyone has a take on it. So reality gets blurred very easily. So I guess we have to manage it and kind of like, okay, this is what I think's happened and you've got to try and sort of go with your gut and explore what your gut's kind of saying. But there, yeah, there's infinite. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure book the size of The Lord of the Rings, you know. It's like there are infinite possibilities.
It's exhausting. Mm. And then when you open it up to things like Facebook, so you've had a Facebook page for Owen for, what, the last 6-odd years?
Since, what, 2009? Yeah, longer than that. For a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what have been the pros and the cons of that, do you think?
A lot of cons and not many pros. Well, pros is it gets the message out there. And look, pros, at the end of the day, if I could wish for one thing, it would be that there would be a young person somewhere who's thinking about taking their own life or thinking about running away. And running away is like taking your own life in a sense because you're ending part of your life that everyone knows and you're starting again somewhere else. I would hope that they would hear Owen's story and go, okay, this is a really bad idea. I need to dig deeper. I need to find someone who gives a crap and I need to work this out. I would hope at the end of the day there would be people that hear even what we're saying now and just be like, well, I'm really struggling, but I'm going to dig deeper. I'm going to find someone to help me or find a solution for this problem, a positive solution.
That's definitely a very important, powerful message. Mm. And we found that over the years, we'd have countless young men typically write to us through Dan's Facebook page or the Gmail and say that they had been thinking about disappearing. Mm. They were struggling. They wanted to just vanish. But they had seen the impact that Dan's disappearance had had on our family and his friends. And instead, they had sought support for their mental health and they hadn't gone missing. Mm. And that was absolutely, without doubt, the best outcome of the entire campaign for Dan was to know that other people who had considered disappearing didn't, because they were able to see what it does to those who are left behind, which is absolute torment. And I can understand that people that are really struggling might not be able to see that, but that message is so important to put out there, to talk before you do walk.
Yeah. Mm. That gives me a lot of hope hearing that too, because I think there are probably people that have been in the same situation. I think the cons of it though were when I really tried to, I had this idea that, well, I don't know how many millions or billion people there are in the world, but I basically felt that I needed to reach one person in every million people. And if I could do that, then one person in every million people would know something about, potentially something about Owen. So I did do a Facebook promotion, not promotion, but like call it, to try and get the likes up and try and reach a larger audience. And there were people that got on there and said, face it, your brother's dead, you know. And I was just like, oh, you keyboard warrior, I just want to reach down the thing and, you know, be violent towards your face. But, you know, I was so disappointed in humanity at that time because I just thought, how dare you say that? If it was your brother, you would be devastated, you'd be shocked, you would be furious if someone said that. But I got so many of those and it was just like, and initially I would respond and it was just the worst thing you could ever do because those trolls would just keep coming at you and coming at you and they didn't care. It was fun for them. It was like a big game. And So, well, one pro of it is that I've learned not to respond to keyboard warriors on Facebook and social media. I mean, it's given me a lot of strength and a lot of ability to be able to just not respond to stupidity like that. I think the relationships I've built with people and just the conversations I've had have been a pro, and just and seeing people respond kindly and with kindness has been, that's been good. And obviously associating with people through MPAN has been amazing, and getting to know you has been amazing, because it's like a new family member, you know, you're like a sister to me, and I'm sure if you met my sister, she'd feel the same way about you too.
What did prompt you to come into that? I think you were the first family member that ever stopped by the office. And I was so like caught off guard. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm a professional, be professional. But it's weird because I'm constantly going between, like, I wear both hats. I am a sister, yeah, and I am, you know, running this little charity. And I was so thrilled that you came in to sit down with me and tell me about what was going on. But what prompted you to do that?
It was so long ago, I can't quite remember, but I think that basically I was so impressed by what you were doing, I wanted to get behind that. I wanted to support that because, well, the only other avenue of help and support was missing persons, and they weren't able to give the same amount of empathy and support, and I could really see massive value in what you were doing. And I think I was just at a point, I was just like, oh, this is ridiculous. I just don't know what else to do. And then I can't even remember how I found out about MPAN, but I was just like, oh, I definitely have to connect and be part of this.
I've noticed that earlier on in our chat, you used past tense, and tense is a difficult thing. It's something that I think all families are very sensitive or can be very sensitive
tense
to.
About tense, yeah.
Yes, they do get tense about tense. But that you referred to Owen in past tense, and that the, you know, 2015 finding from the coroner, it's just a piece of paper. But does that change how you feel? Does it change your relationship with hope now?
Oh, the coroner's report?
Mm, and the conclusion, which was...
I think it's invalid, to be honest. I give it no validity whatsoever. I think that, honestly, it was just... there was a push towards closing a bunch of cases that have been lingering around for way too long. And 30 years is way too long. 29 years is way too long. I don't give any validity to it because I have no evidence. There is nothing to indicate that he's still alive, but there's clearly nothing to indicate that he's not. So I didn't realise I was referring to Owen in past tense.
No, but I think it's natural because some things, it's relevant. Like you say, he used to do that thing because he used to do it when he was here and you knew him, but now it's been 30 years. Maybe you don't know what he's currently doing. You know, it's tricky. It's a tricky thing to navigate.
And it's also been more than half my lifetime that he's been missing. So I have no, like people are like, oh, where you got lots of photos. I'm like, no, I've got no photos because it was 30 years ago. Well, I have photos, but... people ask the silliest things. Have you got a current photo? I'm like, no.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell me where I can get one?
Yeah, that'd be nice. Or have you got more up to date? Oh, it's just like, yeah. But I mean, people,
they don't get it.
Unless you're in that space, you don't get it. But I think the coroner ruling that was just, it was really hard. But at the same time, I kind of didn't really put any faith in that. I don't think Owen would have taken his own life. I don't think that he... I think he's still alive. I think he just feels way too uncomfortable to re-engage. And I get that. That would be difficult.
It's weird because I'm not sure if... Well, you must get it, where people are like, what do your instincts tell you? You know, what's your feeling? Because this idea that... people who are close, people who are related to one another have these connections that when something happens.
You shouldn't be asking me this question. not you, but...
Yeah, no, I know. People, but they can't help themselves because in movies it's like, oh, they have feelings and they can imagine. And I remember that being one of my most hated questions when Dan was still missing because, yeah, we were really close, but I still have no bloody idea. Like, obviously, I have no idea. And that doesn't... discount or diminish the strength of the bond that we shared. Mm. But I think that there is that notion that families have instincts about these things, and it can be really distressing when you're put on the spot like that from a stranger, from, you know, a journalist, that you're supposed to have this internal knowledge of where they are.
I mean, just put my fingers to my forehead and operate my ESP. You know,
but your belief is that Owen is still alive. He's out there.
And what sort of brother would I be if I said, well, I reckon he's dead? You know, what a... I mean, it's sort of a... It's really a ridiculous... Not really. I mean, I guess I get it. They're kind of trying to come up with their own hypothesis about what's happened. But obviously my best case scenario is my brother's still alive. He's living somewhere. He's very happy. He's got the things that he wants. Obviously my instincts are that my brother's still alive, but in reality, I've got no freaking idea, because if I did, I would find him. When people ask that, I hope it doesn't come... I'm not coming across as being all bitter and twisted, but I'm not. And I respect that people are trying to be helpful. I guess people have to ask questions and they are curious, but sometimes curiosity is not the greatest. It's not helpful.
I wonder about bitterness and how over almost 30 years you must feel, because I remember meeting a woman, I think maybe a year after Dan disappeared, and she told me that her brother had been missing for, I think, 20, 25 years. And I just kind of, my stomach sank and I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to even fathom that that was possible. That was way too far down the track. That couldn't be my situation. How is it when you see families in the media nowadays? You know, it's been a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of months, or a few years. How do you look at them? Do you feel, is it just sort of empathy? Is it like, oh, are you, you know, there's hope and they've got all that enthusiasm, but in, you know, give them 10 years and that's going to drop off. Like, you can't help but be jaded by this.
Well, I try not to be, and I think you sort of gravitate, or I gravitate between being mad about it, being sad about it, all kinds of emotions. But I think what I tend to keep doing, so I don't become jaded and bitter and everything else, is just keep forgiving my brother. And I literally sometimes just say, you know, God, I forgive my brother for disappearing. I know it probably sounds weird saying that, but I notice with me, if I hold in a lot of unforgiveness, my back starts to get really sore, I start to get really tense, I start to be really cranky. And when I notice that in myself, then I'm just like, all right, I've got some stuff I need to forgive and let go of. And I let go of this, not in a sense of I don't care, but more just I'm not going to take on things that I can't take on. And I can't take on my brother disappearing. I can take it on, but I mean, what I mean is I can't carry that burden. Thankfully, I've got a lot of friends that, you know, say, you know, let's carry our burdens together. But I just keep really coming back to, well, if I see people in that situation, I feel a great amount of empathy for them. I want to reach out to them. I just want to say everything's going to be okay. Even if it's not okay, it's still going to be okay.
Well, that's often, I think, a lot of people do in times of tragedy turn to those opportunities where they feel that they can channel that energy in a positive light and make some sort of contribution. And I can't tell you how grateful we are to have had you on a myriad of different MPAN projects, taking photos and doing all sorts of things, lifting boxes of coffee cups and being such a huge help, because that is a way in which... Like, obviously, your brother is still missing, and this kind of what we're doing isn't directly going to lead to him being found, most likely not, but it's helping the greater cause. It's supporting this community of people that are left behind, that are typically unheard, unseen, forgotten about, because understandably, when someone's missing, it's their face that we're putting out there, and they're the main event, you know. That's the focus of everyone's attention. But longer and longer term, we've really got to think about the people that are left behind that are impacted by that, because the impact is enormous.
Yeah, absolutely.
In every way, shape and form. I wonder, is this within your own marriage, your marriage to the lovely Lisa, has that put a strain on those types of relationships in your life? Is this something that is a cause of tension at times when you do have commitments, say, around Missing Persons Week or, you know, being distracted by, not distracted, of course, it's a big thing in your life, but has it put a strain on your marriage at all?
I don't think so. I have to say, I feel uniquely blessed to have found someone in my life. I mean, we've been married 23 years and look, I'm sure I'm a huge, ginormous, huge pain in Lisa's butt sometimes, but she seems to think she's the same to me, but I'm pretty sure I'm a bigger pain in the butt. It's a competition. So.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. So I'm trying to be the bigger pain in the butt. I think the one thing you learn, and we're still learning stuff about each other, which is really cool, but I think the one thing you learn, well, Lisa said she's learned about me, is when I'm quiet, then there's something very wrong and it's okay to ask, but if I'm still quiet, then she just kind of leaves me to it. And she often says, I don't know what to say. I'm like, that's okay. Sometimes saying nothing is saying everything.
It is hard when there's a very unique tragedy that has happened to you and the person closest to you can't really get it to, you know, the same extent, of course.
Yeah.
But then it's so wonderful when you learn that there are other people out there in the world that understand pretty much exactly what you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that for the first, I think, year or so, I hadn't been able to connect with any other sister whose brother was missing. And it is a very isolating experience.
Mm.
How long had it been? Because, you know, when it happened to me, there was social media and I was able to put feelers out. How long was it before you first connected to someone in that space that you felt could understand what you were going through?
Probably meeting you, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think I have really talked to anyone at the Missing Persons Day launch. And that's probably why I was so keen to meet you, because no one had really talked about it. I mean, there was no, like, I don't know, it was just missing persons is something that no one really, you know, talked much about. And that whole, the question you asked earlier about the police and whether they just sort of fobbed it off as, oh, he's a 20-year-old. I'm pretty sure that most people thought that. They're just like, you know, get over it. He's 25. He can do whatever he wants. He's just taken off. So, yeah, I'll be honest. I think you were probably the first person that I could have a real, for real conversation with.
Gosh, that blows my mind.
Mm.
That's so much harder. I think I've been so supported by other people all around the world that I've been able to connect with through this in the last 9 years that I've kind of been living in this space, and it's
yeah.
been a tremendous help. So I can't even imagine how much harder it must have been 30 years ago to be in that position and at 20 years old.
Mm. Honestly, can't remember ever really connecting with anyone. I think even when I was, I was invited by the Missing Persons to come to their launch at McDonald's in Bourke Street years ago, well, 2005 or something, and I just remember feeling really alone because I didn't know anyone there. And I think I may have chatted briefly to someone and it may have been a bit of like, hey, you know, I'm really sorry to hear about your uncle or your sister or whatever, and vice versa, you know, sorry to hear about your brother, but that would have been about it. And I just remember going on camera and then saying, you know, oh, tell us your story and, you know, what happened to you with that. And then when they said, how do you feel? And I just completely lost my SH1T, you know, like in front of all these strangers that I'd never met. And then it was all over, like, primetime TV.
That's the money shot.
And I remember the next day going to school and just feeling really awkward, but kids were coming up and saying, just nodding at me and just like giving me a look as if to say, I saw you on TV, but I'm not going to say anything about it. And it was like this sense of solidarity. I remember these two girls that were in this band that I ran at school who came up and said, look, if you need to step out of your class at any time today, we're in the year 12 corridor and you can just send someone to come get us and we'll look after your class if you just need to take a break. And I was just like, wow, that was amazing. Yeah, but and I think it's just because no one wants to talk about or no one wanted to talk about this sort of stuff. Because
it's awkward.
Yeah. It's not something you want splashed all over primetime TV and that people want to talk about, because it's, yeah, it's fraught with struggles with mental health and it's fraught with very uncomfortable conversations. Which, by the way, I'm very happy to have uncomfortable conversations with you anytime.
Good.
Because you make uncomfortable conversations comfortable, so that's okay.
Why, thank you.
You're right.
But yeah, it is interesting because on both sides of this, typically, because like I said, 85% of the time, the person who's disappeared has a mental health issue, and the impact on those left behind is profound. I mean, it's not just emotional and psychological, it's also financial, and there are a myriad of ways that people are impacted by having a loved one disappear. Mm. But is that something that you have noticed and thought about yourself, your own mental health from 20 years of age, going through your entire adult life carrying this burden? Has it had a big impact, you think, on your emotional and mental health?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I find myself when I was working in schools as a counsellor, having to work desperately hard not to project my own crap onto a situation and not to kind of, I guess, tell my own story because, well, I wasn't there for me, I was there for them. But I think the biggest thing I've always struggled with is rejection and feeling like I'm not good enough. Yeah, I think just pure unadulterated rejection. That sense of like my brother took off and he's wanted to start again. And it's probably a bit selfish to feel like that, but that rejection of family, I think is, and it's not just my brother, really. I think it's just my own relationship with my father and my mother too. I think being unable to accept affection from people and things like that sometimes. I'm a lot better with it now, but it used to be particularly, you know, people my brother's age would give me a hug and say, I love you. I'd feel really uncomfortable. And I have a couple of friends who they say that to me all the time. Oh, you know, I love you, man. And I'm like, I'd just be like, yeah, right back at you. But now I've challenged myself to be like, I love you too. And I do. And the good side of that is I've noticed how many brothers I actually really do have. I mean, they're substitute brothers. They're not Owen, but they're damn good substitutes. You know, they're really a lot of guys who have stepped in the gap for me and just been like, hey, I'll be a brother. So that's pretty cool. But I think I don't really struggle too much with depression like I used to. And I think the turning point for me was really discovering, I guess, a couple of things. And one was going to Cambodia and seeing my sponsor kids and seeing how they lived and me going, wow, my life is absolutely peaches compared to what other people are living through. And what can I do to help? That's the next thing I do. But also just finding hope in faith. And I know, you know, Australians sometimes like, oh, you're not religious, are you? For me, it's not religion. It's the relationship. It's believing that there is something or someone, in this sense, God, who I think is so much bigger than my situation, so much bigger than anything that I'm going through, and a sense that he's got my back no matter what.
I mean, each to their own. We all have to manage with this nightmare somehow, and coping mechanisms are broad. I know that mine is MPAN, always was, to take a very practical approach to Dan's disappearance. But you've got to combat the hopelessness, the overwhelming sense of hopelessness and helplessness that you inevitably feel when someone in your life just vanishes. So it is interesting how people cope in so many different ways, but you've got to have something.
And there's something, also something that drives you as well, I suppose, in a positive way. And for me, that's playing the drums and playing the drums with people, hanging out with musicians, because, you know, the drummer joke is, what do you call someone who hangs out with musicians? It's a drummer. So now I'm actually reinventing that paradigm anyway, because we do these drum sheds where we get drummers together, and I'm going to start something called Musicians Hanging Out with Drummers. It's a bit cheeky, but that sense of, though, of using something like the drums, which are generally not socially acceptable because they're loud, and it's one way to really make neighbours move out if they're renters, Which has happened a number of times in my next door. I have no idea why people keep moving out from next door, but no. But
I need to get you over to my place.
Yeah. By the way, yeah, I'm happy to come and do it for free if you want to come play the drums to annoy your neighbours. Happy to do that. But getting drummers together and playing the drums is cool. But then I notice some people start talking about stuff, and that's really cool. There's informal mental health help, you know, like it's getting people around each other and just going, hey, you know, like, and I like doing it in local communities and getting someone in a local community to kind of host the event, host the drum shed, as we call them. And then if, you know, there's something they're struggling with, you can kind of make, well, you can plug them in with that local person and they can make sure that they're going to be safe, they're going to be all right. I reckon that's beautiful. And I look at my life and I think, well, if my brother hadn't gone missing and if my parents hadn't divorced and this and that and everything else hadn't happened, what sort of person would I be? And would I just be obsessed with getting a Porsche and having a house and, you know, actually I don't even like Porsches that much. You know, would I be obsessed with all the things that aren't that important? And so in a way it's a blessing in disguise. So I don't know. I've met some amazing people, been able to have great conversations with people. So thanks, Owen. Thank you, because it's changed my life in a way that I think it's sort of sad but also beautiful at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think he would love to know that, as much as, you know, you do imagine him finding out that you're looking for him and being, you know, reluctant to reach out. But I think it is important that we give families an opportunity to communicate messages like that are, you know, yes, this has been difficult, but some great things have come out of it. And you have, you know, a sense of purpose and connection that perhaps you wouldn't have had he not disappeared. So it's good things can come from tragedy, and they do.
Yeah, and I still have a relationship with my brother, I guess in the sense that I still think about him. I will never forget him. Although I'd love to, you know, Owen, I'd love to form some new memories with you if you don't mind. But I understand too if he doesn't want to. I think I used to take that really personally and be like, oh, man, why won't my brother come back? I'm a good person. I'm a nice guy. You know, you'd want to hang out with me, I promise. But now I'm like, okay, well, I'm sad that 30 years has nearly passed without seeing you and knowing you, but I'm always open to seeing you and knowing you. In the meantime, I'll use our story to inspire other people and encourage other people and, try and make a difference.
One last thing I did want to... Earlier you were talking about Facebook and how there are both pros and cons. And the people get confused. It is, you know, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yes.
And combine that with the fact that people do want to help and they also want to sometimes play, you know, detective. I get that, totally get that. But in a situation like yours where you've got this Facebook page for your brother as a tool to, you know, get some information and put it out there, sometimes things can get in the way of that flow and cause some heartache and,
that's true.
It's time-consuming. And so what happened there?
There was a situation in America, in I think Seattle, no, it was Portland, where a young Owen went missing. It was last year. And I started getting this flood of emails from people going, I think I've seen your brother at blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, hang on, they're referring to like a school and stuff. And I'm like, I was very confused and it was very upsetting because suddenly I got the trolls as well going, just face it, he's dead, he's killed himself. And you're just like, but I'm really confused because I didn't feel like they were talking about my brother. But it turns out there was an Owen Kay who'd gone missing. I think his last name was Klinger, who'd gone missing in the US. And the family, like me, had set up an email and set up a Facebook page and stuff as well to try and find Owen who'd gone missing from, I think, from college. So I started getting these emails and my email was helpfindowen@gmail.com. Obviously, because that was taken, they made it helpfindownk@gmail.com. So I started getting all these emails. And I've tried not to get angry about it, or emotional, I think is probably the better way, about it, and send emotive emails back. But I eventually sent an email to the family saying, hey, look, my name's Dylan. My older brother Owen's been missing for 29 years. I'm getting these emails. Could you please remind people to put the K after Help Find Owen, because I'm getting a lot of emails and it's not helpful. It's just stirring things up that, you know, that don't need to be stirred up. And then I started forwarding the emails from people to them because I was concerned that they were missing out on information people were trying to provide. The sad part about that story from the US was that they ended up finding the body of the young man, and you know, for me it was like I felt really shattered, and that was really hard to see that, because it's like, well, it was very close to home, well, not literally but in figurative sense. So yeah, being able to communicate with people and being able to connect with people has its upsides and its downsides. I think the only message I would have for people who don't have missing family members is don't be curious to the person whose family member is missing. If you're curious, exercise some form of initiative and do your own finding out. And if you're a wannabe private detective, don't develop your skills on a missing person's case, because that's just not cool. I mean, develop your skills on someone's missing cat or dog or something. And the most helpful thing anyone can do for a missing person or in a missing person's case is don't go to the family members and tell them. Go to Crime Stoppers in Australia. Ring Crime Stoppers and report it to them. Because every time that I've had people give me information, I remember going to the police that were handling the case and they said, why are you even dealing with this information? Just tell them to call Crime Stoppers. The only problem with that is most people don't. They associate Crime Stoppers with the police, and some people don't have a healthy relationship with the police, I suppose, so they're afraid to call Crime Stoppers because it's like, oh, they're going to want to know information. But you can be completely anonymous, but if it's a fair dinkum lead, then share it, because at the end of the day, the people that can do the most with that information are Crime Stoppers. They have networks of people. The worst thing you can do is go to a family member and give them a false sense of hope. It's like that letter from my brother's ex-wife's mum pretending to be my brother. Like, it gave us hope for a split second, but then it smashed us because we realised suddenly it wasn't. I know maybe that sounds callous to say that, but don't contact people directly who have missing family members, because if it's a bogus lead or if it's not real, then...
It's difficult because, I don't know, it's obviously case by case. Some families do want to have that direct avenue of communication with
the public. Or maybe actually, I wouldn't say don't contact them, but maybe put a bit more thought into it. You know, I know people
be sensitive.
People are trying to be helpful, but I've had people say, oh, yeah, I saw this guy in Canberra just like your brother. I'm like, can you get a picture? And they're like, oh, yeah, I took a picture with my phone. They sent me this photo and my brother has a very pronounced dimple in his chin, and the person has no dimple in the chin. So if you think maybe the person might be, you know, a missing person, have a good look at the photo, make sure that you, you know, give it a bit of thought. And don't, I mean, and then you get other people who are like a guy who's like, oh, I've got this information on your brother, but I'm not going to tell you. You got to give me $500 in iTunes cards and then I'll give you the information.
Yeah, it is frustrating. It is hard, because I remember a few years ago there was a picture of a guy on Facebook at a train station in Melbourne, and he was unidentified, and what had happened was that he had been hit by a train and killed, and people were trying to figure out his identity. Mm. And he had dark, short hair, was in his early to mid-20s, and that was pretty much all the information that was out there. It was in Melbourne, and, you know, so people drew connections and were like, oh, my gosh, Lauren, I think I know what happened to Dan. I'm so sorry, but he was killed by a train
yeah.
at Camberwell. which is like 2 kilometres away from where we live in Melbourne. Yeah, and this happened close to 80 times over those, you know, 5-6 weeks, because it's constantly being shared all around the internet. And, you know, Dan's page had 70,000 followers. So people coming across this and going, the age matches, all the demographics kind of link up. It's got to be Dan. I've solved the case. Oh my gosh. And we had repeatedly told people, you know, it's not Dan. And then you are connected to these cases. So I watched that unfold. And eventually, after a really long period of time, it was found that he was a Swedish tourist or international student. And you do follow that journey for the family, and you do grieve for that family, and you find that you are connected to families all around the world that are going through this journey. And it's heartbreaking. And so all of a sudden, like, you know, I, up until 25, 26, I had a very normal, like, carefree life. I was at uni and traveling around and blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden, there's just a lot of grief and pain and heartache and morbidity. Like, I found myself, I'd jog along the Yarra in Melbourne, and when I would see things floating in the river, I'd go, is that a body? You know, because suddenly you're in this world where all of these dark things do happen. And so you're hyper alert all the time. And it has a real impact on the way that you live and operate, inevitably.
Just like I'm in a cafe in Melbourne, where some guy walks in, I'm like, oh no, it's not Owen. Where was I? I think I was in Fitzroy, where Owen used to hang out a lot. I was in a cafe, and there was a guy, and they were like same length hair, same build as Owen. And it's just like, you could feel my heart beating faster. But obviously, Owen would be in his 50s now. So he's not a 25-year-old. And my last frame of reference is the long-haired Owen, you know, with his lopsided grin and, you know, just, you know, the way he, I guess he was slim build and all that sort of stuff. For all I know now, he's like a 50-year-old big fat guy, I don't know.
It's weird to think, it must be obviously for you especially, that Owen is now 55. And you've missed out on these milestones. I mean, you were there for his 18th and his 21st. But on birthdays, especially the big ones, how do you feel? What do you tend to do on difficult days like that?
Well, I've got it in my calendar, Owen's birthday, and I've got when he went missing as well on my calendar as well. So like on those days, I do feel pretty crap. You know, you feel sad, and I'm like, okay, I feel sad, but someone deserves to feel good today. So I always try and turn those days around to something good. Even if I'm feeling a bit not so great, I want someone else to feel good. So,
well, I think you're doing a very impressive job of maintaining your sanity. Something like this can really destroy a human. And you've had to live with it for such an extended period of time. So my hat goes off to you. I hope it's not too much longer, and I hope that resolution really is just around the corner, fingers crossed.
If there are any people out there who are struggling with this stuff, feel free to reach out to me. I know I'm like, trolls, leave me alone, but people who are going through a similar thing, if it's a new thing or if you've had a family member that's been missing for a long time, more than happy to have a coffee. Yeah. I think that's what my life is going to be about, is just being there for other people and being a blessing to other people. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, my life is not crap. My life is good. But if I can't be a blessing to my brother, I'll be a blessing to someone else instead.
Whatever happened to Owen, we don't know the ending. Time has passed everywhere except for the world of this story, where it is forever the summer of 91, when a man made a carefully considered decision to move out of sight. Always drawn to life's unanswerable questions, Owen has now joined their company. What happened to him makes us reassess the claim we feel we have on our loved ones. How well can we ever know anyone? Dylan remembers his brother as a complex man with a generous open-mindedness. The mysteries of Owen's life continue, and behind them all, there's Dylan, clutching 100 ends to 100 possible stories. In cutting himself adrift, Owen inadvertently set his brother adrift too. Like others who remain behind, Dylan is left with nothing but the painful vestiges of a long-burning love. Owen Redman's episode was adapted from original writing by David Halliday. Missing Persons Advocacy Network is an unfunded charity run by me, Lauren O'Keefe. In 2016, we started a project that paired authors and artists with Australian families to tell their stories, to humanise missing loved ones beyond the stats they're typically reduced to. Though it grew to comprise murals, songs, sculptures, documentaries, and coffee cups, our modern take on the old milk carton campaigns of the 80s, it began with a book called Two Short Stories. The What's Missing podcast was inspired by that book. These stories are but some of thousands. Help us help the usually unseen, unheard, forgotten community of those left behind by heading to our website where you can donate or get involved, mpan.com.au. That's mpan.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter using the same handle, mpanaus. That's mpanaus. If you have a missing loved one, check out our guide at missingpersonsguide.com.